Welcome back, I'm Erin.
And I'm Ethan.
So in this episode, we are primarily going to focus on discussing some of the topics that were brought up in the third episode of the Oxygen series. Among those topics, we talk about the theory that the show posited for the missing hour of time between when Mara presumably left Amherst and when she got into the accident at the Weathered Barn Corner. We also get into a pretty lengthy discussion about the dispatch logs and about eyewitness accounts and some of the common problems with witness statements. So similar to the last episode, we set it up by playing a clip from the show and then jumping right into our discussion. So as always, feel free to reach out to us with any questions, clarifications, or criticism.
Another wrench to throw in is she picked up the accident forms from the previous car accident with her dad's vehicle at UMass.
Right.
And I believe she picked those up, right? She picked those up after she left UMass.
Where would she pick those up from?
Police station, DMV.
Yep. So the only time frame for her to pick those up would have been before she went on the trip north. So that could just add the extra time in there.
And the Hadley Police Department is down Route 9, so that could give her about 45 minutes if the police were taking a while. Could have.
If she simply picked up accident forms, then the missing hour is meaningless.
So in episode 3, the first thing that really stuck out to me, they're trying to account for the missing hour.
Yes. So you're referring to their calculation that there's an extra hour of time beyond what it would have taken Mara to get to where she ended up based on when she was known to have left.
Yes. And I don't know if they came to the conclusion that they believe that she had stopped at the DMV or at, they said the Hadley Police Department.
Yeah, they mentioned both. Well, she could have picked it up at the police department or the DMV, Art says.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. I wasn't aware that you could pick this form up at the police station. So as far as I know, this is a form that you need to pick up at the DMV. It's a Mass DOT form. It's called the Motor Vehicle Crash Operator Report. And it's for anyone who is involved in an accident where there's damage over $1,000 needs to fill out this form in Massachusetts and send it to the registrar within 5 days of the crash.
Okay.
So I believe this is the form that she would have been picking up. And the only reason I could think that she would have gone to the police station would be to perhaps get a printout of the accident report to make it easier to fill out. But we would have had a record of that. If she printed out the accident report, there would definitely be a record.
Mm-hmm.
And the closest DMV to where she was in Amherst was between the university and Route 91, the Route 91 on-ramp. So it's about 6 miles from UMass to the on-ramp of Route 91. We know that she went to the ATM at the corner of University Drive and Route 9 in Amherst. And then I believe that she went to Liquors 44, it looked like, from where they had filmed, which is right around the corner, technically in Hadley, but right around the corner from the ATM. And that's about 5 miles between that point and the on-ramp to Route 91 North, going straight on Route 9. Now, in between those two points, the liquor store and Route 91 was a DMV in Hadley. So right in between.
Yeah, so if she was going to DMV, she could have easily just quickly stopped.
Quickly gone in and out. It doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, interesting.
They've actually closed that location, and I have to wonder if it's because it just didn't get a lot of traffic. No pun intended.
Yeah.
Because I had to go in there a couple of times throughout my time at UMass, and there was never anyone in there.
Interesting. So even the joke about, like, well, maybe she got held up because, like, it's the DMV and everything takes forever, like, that doesn't even really work.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to imagine it taking more than, like, 15 minutes.
Right. It's possible. Of course it did.
Yeah.
But it was just picking up a form. It wasn't renewing her license or anything. So
yeah.
I don't think that she would have even had to take a number.
Yeah, so the show presents it as like, oh, well, it easily could have been explained, the hour gap, if she went to the police station, because that might have taken an hour based on where it was. But what you're saying is like, no, that doesn't actually fit all that well. Or it's like kind of a stretch to say that it definitely would account for the hour. Like, maybe.
I don't think it accounts for it because Well, for one, I don't think that she would have gone to the police station. I think that she would have known that she had to go to the DMV to pick up these forms, even if they were available at the police station.
You wouldn't opt for the police station if you could go to the DMV.
Right, unless it was to pick up the accident report, because you might think that would be helpful. But
there's no reason to think she had it, right?
No, they haven't released everything that was in her car, but they did say that the DMV forms were in the car, and they did not say that the accident forms were.
Right, so. Why would they hide the fact that the accident reports were in the car?
Right, so, yeah, I think it makes more sense that she probably went to the DMV location that was literally, like, right in the middle of her journey down Route 9 from the liquor store to Route 91. It was very convenient, actually.
Yeah, I would say that's a critique of what the show posited, because if everything we just said is correct, it's like, you really should have said that on the show instead of saying, like, well, maybe the whole hour is not mysterious because maybe she went to the police station. Like, yeah, but there's no good reason to think she would have gone to the police station, and there's very good reason to think she would have gone to this DMV that you didn't even mention.
That's if she even stopped. She could have printed this online.
Yeah.
We know that she had a printer because she printed things from MapQuest.
Right. So she might not have even needed to start up at the DMV, which is a very good point, too. Yeah,
she might not have had to stop at all. So the hour is still a question mark for me.
Yeah, I think a more reasonable interpretation of the hour is that it's like a very big question mark.
Because it's at least an hour from our calculations, right?
Yeah.
It was like at least an hour and 10 or 15 minutes, I think.
I would say we have no convincing explanation. Like, the police station theory to me is not a convincing hypothesis. You need something better than that.
Yeah. I mean, I think they've mentioned it a couple of times that she might have stopped to eat.
Yeah.
Of course, the list of things that she could have done is infinite.
Yeah.
But what evidence is there?
She disappears on Monday. What happens the weekend before that? Her dad comes to visit. He came there in order to help her get a new car. Even though everybody I've talked to that were friends with her at UMass that saw her that weekend, she never mentioned to them that she was looking for a car, that that's why Fred came in. So they forgot to mention that they were looking for a car when they got together with friends. But Fred had to explain to police how he came to have $4,000 with him that weekend. And he tells them, you know, hey, look, I had $4,000 with me. You might need to know that. And they're like, well, tell us a little bit more about that, Fred. And Fred says, well, yeah, we were in a hurry. So on the way to UMass, I stopped and withdrew $400 in cash from several different ATMs because that was the limit. You know, think about that for a second. Who would do that? Why does Fred not write a check? Anybody's going to take a personal check. You know, cash, they might say, is easier. But then why didn't Fred think forward enough to stop at his bank and withdraw that cash in one sum before he came to the University of Massachusetts? His story makes no logical sense.
So you took out money, cash, for the car?
That was in Connecticut. My bank was back up here, so I couldn't take much money from the bank. I had to get it from an ATM, and so I could only take a chunk at a time.
So what ultimately happened to that $4,000?
I put it back in the bank, in her account. I put money in there for her when she was missing. In case she needed money, I would see that she withdrew money.
That's a pretty good technique. We actually do that in a lot of cases.
And I wanted to. She never did. No.
So another thing that they mentioned on episode 3 was the question about the $4,000 that Fred Murray had taken out to help Maura buy a car. It's been sort of thrown out there as this suspicious element. So when you hear about the $4,000, it's in the context of Fred coming up to Amherst the weekend before she disappeared to help her find a new car. And he was quoted in the Boston Magazine article as saying that he stopped at different ATMs to withdraw the $4,000. So it looks like on the surface that somebody is looking for money in a hurry.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is still his opinion after hearing this new information, but recently Renner was convinced that the $4,000 was intended to either fix a big problem that Maura had or to help her disappear. So for him, it sort of plays into the idea that he brought this money to help her start a new life.
Fred?
Yeah.
But he posits that she was running from Fred. I guess at different times he's had different theories. So that was probably an older theory before he came up with the she's running from Fred idea.
This was in August of 2015.
Oh.
So it wasn't that long ago.
Okay.
I haven't heard a lot about the $4,000 recently, But I think it's worth pointing out because there are people that are going to come into it and see that piece of information and be suspicious.
Yeah. And suspicious. So there's a couple details to this, right? Because he takes out the $4,000 and he takes it out like in pieces, right? Like little pieces at a time. So that seems suspicious at first glance.
Yeah. I think that the question that has been presented is, well, why didn't he go to a bank or write a check?
Sure.
And the presumption is that either going to the bank or writing a check was more convenient than cash. But they did a good job of dispelling that in the third episode because Fred explains that, well, his bank branch was in eastern Massachusetts and he had been working in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
So it probably would have been impossible for him to get to eastern Mass to withdraw all the money at once during banking hours, which are working hours.
Yeah.
So it actually would make a lot of sense and be more convenient to withdraw the money from ATMs like he did.
This is one of those things that people looking at this case now, there's two ways they can go wrong analyzing this information. They can say, well, I can go to a bank anywhere because I have Bank of America. Okay, but he didn't. And
clearly,
by the way, that was much less weird back in 2004 than it is now. Like now, like everyone and his dog has one of these huge mega banks. But at that time, it was still very common for people to have a small community bank.
Yeah, community banks didn't start collapsing until, I think, like 2007.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, and he didn't speak to this specifically, but we're assuming that he only has one bank account, which most adults have more than one.
Yeah, what if he took out $4,000 from three bank accounts? He might have had like a savings account and a checking account. And he couldn't do a transfer because he wasn't at his bank, so he couldn't just put it all in his checking account and write a check. He also might not have wanted to write a check if you're buying a car, especially if you're buying from a private party. Often, actually, usually, they're not going to take a personal check.
Yeah.
And what kind of car is he buying for $4,000 that's not a private party? Like, is he going to a dealer and paying $4,000 for a car? Maybe. But they're also going to prefer cash, and they're going to give you a discount for cash. So, like, yeah, not writing a check, not weird. The only thing that you should be looking at is it's the $4,000. Like the whole 8 ATMs, multiple, you know, there's reasonable reasons. If you need $4,000, this is like basically what it's going to look like. Or it's not weird that it would look like this.
Yeah, I completely agree. The other thing that he says that none of her friends said that they recall Fred and Maura going car shopping. Well, Renner only spoke to one person that Maura saw that weekend, and it was Kate. So she didn't know that Maura was car shopping. And in his book, this was always really curious to me because he said it a couple of times that nobody knew about this car shopping outing, except literally, and I'm reading from his book on page 238, whatever else happened that weekend, Fred was definitely helping Maura find a new car. He, meaning Billy, explained, adding that they had visited the same dealership where he had purchased his own car. And this is backed up by Fred's statement to the UMass police where he said, we started in Hadley looking at cars, $4,000 on my person. We went to a place in Northampton that her boyfriend had good luck with. So that's independently corroborated by two different sources, time and space and distance apart from each other. So I'm going to go ahead and say that's probably true.
No real reason to question it when he's got the evidence for why it's true in his own book.
Except to make it seem as suspicious and interesting as possible. And I admit, when I first heard it, I was like, whoa, wait a second here.
Mm-hmm.
But when you actually think about it logically, it is very clear that she was probably looking for a new car because one of the pieces of information that he fails to mention is that Maura had made a phone call to Reliance Auto that Saturday afternoon, which is a car dealership in Amherst.
Oh, so there's clear evidence that she was looking for a car.
There's actually evidence in her phone records that indicates her intent to buy a car. I don't think that there's any question that they were car shopping. So unless you want to think that they're criminal masterminds, but if that's the case, they probably would have said, hey, Kate, we were car shopping this afternoon, in case you need to know that.
Right.
For any reason.
Also, just like the whole, like, nobody knew. Why would people know? Why would you say that? Like, I could see why it might come up, but why would it have to come up to not be weird? It's only, like, really interesting as it respect, you know, with respect to this case. To Maura and Fred, it's not, like, a thing that they have to, like, explain every second of their day to their friends. It's just, like, it's just bizarre to make the claim as if it's interesting that nobody knew about this car.
Except her boyfriend.
Except her boyfriend, yeah. Except, and then you say, like, well, actually someone did know. But her friends didn't know, Aaron. Her friends didn't know. Or one friend that I talked to didn't know. Isn't that weird? No. Objectively, it's not weird.
It's not that weird.
It was reported that they apparently said there was a man in the car smoking a cigarette.
Someone said it, or the dispatcher took it upon herself to write that, which doesn't seem like that makes any sense to me.
I actually was a dispatcher for like 5 months before I was a police officer, and you take down what they tell you on the phone, and you keep a running log the whole time.
This is pretty amazing. If true, this could mean someone was with Maura when she crashed.
In the dispatch log, the thing that sticks with you, she doesn't say, I think there's somebody smoking a cigarette. She says, a man smoking a cigarette.
I guess we should talk about the dispatch logs that they mentioned in episode 3. I haven't thought about this in a long time, actually.
Dispatch logs? Yeah, I thought it was interesting. They showed a copy of the dispatch logs.
So yeah, they discussed the fact that when Faith Westman called at 727, the dispatch log states that to advise of a vehicle in the ditch right on sharp turn after weathered barn, unknown if PI, personal injury, but can see a man in the vehicle smoking a cigarette, was eastbound on Route 112, but ended up in westbound ditch facing westbound. So they honed in on the man in the vehicle smoking a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. I think that that's really, that's a big question mark for me because it's so specific.
It's so specific. She did specifically say a man smoking a cigarette. Very specific detail. It's not something that you would make up. So, you know, the only explanation if it wasn't a man smoking a cigarette is like she saw something else that looked like a cigarette. But this is a tangent kind of, but I'm just looking at this now. She said she was eastbound, but ended up in westbound ditch. That's not correct, right? She was on the eastbound side of the road. She was facing westbound, but she was not in the westbound ditch, was she? The westbound ditch would be the ditch on the left side of the road as you're traveling east.
Wait a second. I was traveling eastbound on Route 112, but ended up in...
Yeah, westbound ditch, facing westbound.
Yeah, that's wrong.
That's clearly wrong, and I've never noticed that before until just now.
Me neither. Unless they mean, like, ended up on the westbound side, and it's almost like there should be a comma there.
But she's not on the westbound side. She's on the eastbound side of the road.
Yeah.
As far as I know, like I said, everything I've seen said she was on the eastbound side. I don't recall what the accident report said, but I'm just recalling, like, every depiction of the scene that I've ever seen, including on the show, and she's clearly on the eastbound side of the road. Now I'm thinking like, okay, so do we actually have anything that says that she's on the eastbound side elsewhere? Like the accident report would say, wouldn't it?
Let's look at the accident report.
Okay, so... yeah, they clearly show it on the eastbound side. I can see there's a map. They draw a little map.
Well, yeah, on the map, yeah. I wonder if it's stated anywhere. Let's see, responded to a call of a car into a tree. That's, again, as we've stated already, incorrect. When I arrived, I noted the above vehicle parked facing west in the eastbound lane, Wild Amanusic Road.
So he's clearly saying in the eastbound lane. So unless the westbound ditch is somehow on the side of the road with the eastbound lane, which...
And it's not.
Doesn't make any sense. Then there's a contradiction between the accident report and everyone's assumption of where the car was and Faith Westman's. At least what the dispatcher wrote down for Faith Westman's account.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think... This is a civilian, Faith Westman, trying to explain something that is a little bit complicated, right? Like, she's trying to say that she was going one way, and now she is facing the other way, but in the direction that she was heading. So, like, that is a little bit complicated.
Yes. And I thought it was interesting that Art said on the show that he was a dispatcher, and when you're a dispatcher, you write down what the person says, which I'm sure is correct. But it's interesting that you see language here that a normal human being would never use, saying things like, she's on the eastbound side of the road, and her car is facing westbound in the westbound ditch. Like, no person would say that. That's a police officer trying to make the report clear and is eliciting that information based on what the person is telling them, which is going to be more plain language.
Mm-hmm.
And what I can imagine happening is her trying to, like, describe it to the police officer, and the police officer's, or the dispatcher, and the dispatcher is saying, or the, I don't know if they're a dispatcher, but they're, the person taking the record
yeah,
is saying...
Yeah, it would be the dispatcher.
Okay, so she was on the westbound side, or she's, yeah, and she's getting confused with, like, the fact that the car was facing westbound, and she's just saying, yeah, 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 you know, just like confirming what the dispatcher's repeating back to her as the description, and just kind of missed that, like, the westbound ditch is like, no, that's the other side.
So it could very well be a mistake, is what we're saying.
Yeah, my assumption is that it's a mistake. I just find it odd. But there again, it gives you that little bit of doubt where it's like, well, so it's not accurate. You can't really take what's in this dispatch log for gospel. And, you know, when Art says, well, they write down what you tell them, that's not really going to be 100% accurate. It can't be, if you think about it. It's a conversation between two people. And conversation, like, one person's going to, like, say, and certainly in the case where the police officer is trying to get accurate information, they're going to, like, say something back. They're going to try to get agreement. And you can kind of, like, sway someone into, like, saying something that, like, if they weren't having a conversation, they might say it a little bit different.
Sure.
And if that's the case, I'm going to say, like, you know, can we 100% say that, like, Faith Messman really was sure that there was a man smoking a cigarette? She might not have been. She might have said, like, I think it's a man smoking a cigarette. And the dispatcher wrote down she saw a man smoking a cigarette.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I haven't spent a ton of time on this one particular fact, because I don't remember if I've talked about it before, but there's something called the Rashomon effect, which is a principle in social science that states that for every number of witnesses that you have, you're going to have the same number of contradicting accounts of an event.
Mm-hmm.
Because of things like, you know, mistakes in perception or memory. For any number of innocuous reasons, you're going to have many different accounts and even contradicting accounts of the same event.
Yep.
So, yeah, she could have believed that she saw a man, and there could have been something to suggest that it was a man smoking a cigarette. But the other thing I find interesting about that particular fact is that one of the things that was recovered from the car was a cellophane pouch, and it was one of the things that they recovered when they repossessed the car. So we obviously don't know everything that they took into evidence right away, which is why when they went through the list on episode 2, I believe, they didn't mention the alcohol, because that must have been taken into evidence right away.
Right.
So of everything that was repossessed, one of the items was a cellophane pouch. Now, that could be from a pack of gum, or it could be from a pack of cigarettes. Those are the only two things that I can think of off the top of my head that use cellophane pouches. There could be other things, but...
Yeah, I'm just thinking about that now. Why would it be described as a cellophane pouch? Why would you not know what it is? Is it really just clear cellophane with no markings to indicate what it was? I guess it could be. I mean, that almost suggests cigarettes, right?
Yes. Yeah. We obviously don't know. But if I had to guess, I would say that they use the term pouch to suggest it was a cigarette cellophane pouch rather than used for gum, because I would call that a wrapper.
Yeah. So it's possible that there were cigarettes in the car and it was a cigarette that she saw someone smoking.
I don't think that we can dismiss it as a possibility.
Yeah.
I think that the police have directly stated that every piece of evidence that they have points to the fact that Maura was the driver.
Was the driver? As if there could have been someone else in the car.
Well, this was in the context of the episode that I reference all the time in Missing Maura Murray, episode 27. They asked what made the police so sure that it was Maura driving the car as opposed to, say, one of her sisters or even Fred. Because the police seemed to know that it was Maura before they theoretically should have.
Okay.
Unless we're missing a piece of information, of course.
Right.
I've also thought about the fact she might have been listed as a driver on the insurance, and so they might have obtained the information that way if they ran the insurance somehow. But regardless, we don't know how they knew.
Right.
And so they put that question to the police, and the response was, everything we know points to Maura being the driver, which I think that they might have misinterpreted the question a little bit.
Well, I mean, if you look at Butch Atwood, if he didn't say there was anyone other than Maura there and he was right there, then that's it. She's the driver because we don't have any evidence that there was anyone else and Butch Atwood would have seen. You know, like, if I'm the police, to me, that's open and shut. If it's true that Butch Atwood only saw her in and was consistent in all his reports that she was the only one there and he was, like, right at her car, that could have been where they got that assumption from. Here's a question. Did Maura smoke?
No, I do not believe she smoked.
Or did she smoke like you smoke, where it's like maybe sometimes when I'm really stressed, like when I've just been in a car accident?
You know, I think that the assumption has been that everyone says that she hated cigarettes, and, you know, everyone who knows me believes that's the case of me as well. So maybe we shouldn't make that assumption.
Look, if she said she hated cigarettes, well, I would think it's unlikely.
Yes. And given her level of activity, being a runner and all that stuff, although...
You were also a runner, Erin, so...
Yeah. I find it doubtful that it was her, but not outside the realm of possibility. On this sort of subject, when Atwood first saw the picture of Maura, he wasn't convinced it was her. He supposedly said, he was like, yeah, I guess that's her. Like, I think that's, I don't know exactly what he said, but I think that's sort of like the response. Like, he wasn't totally sure that the person that he was looking at was her. And, you know, again, going back to witness memories and perception of events and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Might not be strange.
Yeah, that was tricky. Like, it's kind of dark. Not sure how close he got to her. Mm-hmm. If he didn't actually have that good a look of her, you can imagine his brain created an appearance for her that didn't match what her actual appearance was, and that's why he wasn't sure it was her.
Right. The other thing about it, though, is has always been in the back of my head, but I have sort of mentally chalked up to problems with witness statements in general, mm-hmm. is that when Atwood gave a description, he said that Maura's hair was down, and she always, always wore her hair up.
Right.
So, I don't know. I think it's possible he didn't really get a great look. And so when he was trying to remember back, he's picturing a woman and, you know, mentally replacing certain features that he doesn't specifically recall. Because I think that he said she had shoulder length hair, which is essentially normal length size. Like if he had said she had really short hair or really long hair, something more.
Yeah. Shoulder length is like the default.
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, it's always been in the back of my head, just because we're talking about weirdness with the scene, but I don't really attribute too much to it.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
If he had said that he saw a man, well, now you have two witnesses saying that they see a man. But the fact that he's saying things that also don't sort of correspond to what another witness is saying, and both don't appear to be quite accurate, is actually exactly what you would expect from the Rashomon principle, which tends to be the case over and over.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm thinking through, like, you know, the mindset of this witness or any witness. And, like, let's say her hair was up and he saw her hair up. But he didn't necessarily, like, register in his brain that, like, oh, her hair is up. And the police ask you, like, how long is her hair? And you know you were there. You know you saw her. So in your brain, you're just immediately like, how long was her hair? I guess it was about shoulder length. Like, your brain just fills it in because, like, you're trying to...
Because nothing stood out.
Yeah, nothing stood out. And you wouldn't even be conscious that you're lying, necessarily.
Well, it's not a lie.
Maybe you could, yeah, everybody lies if you listen to Renner. So it's just your brain fills in the memory because there's a gap. Because you literally just can't remember because it wasn't noteworthy to you. What was noteworthy was that there was a young woman on the side of the road. You were offered help. She turned it down. Like, that's the stuff that's, like, you're going to remember. The details about what the person was wearing. I mean, I don't know if everyone had this experience, but I recall more than one time in my life attending a talk or something where someone comes in and then they turn around and they're like, okay, what color is my tie? And it's, like, a simple exercise, but it's, like, no one can ever remember because that's not what you're looking at. You're looking at, I'm looking at the speaker. I'm looking at the scenario, the situation. I'm not focusing on the details. So, yeah. To me, it's totally normal that someone would say her hair was shoulder length when, in fact, they actually have no idea and they're not even aware that they have no idea.
Right. So things that sort of default to the norm,
yeah,
of what someone might say if they weren't really sure, I find less, I guess, suspicious.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like a regression to the mean.
Yeah. So I guess the question is, for the statement that Faith Westman made, mm-hmm. does that seem like something that would be a regression to the mean or suggest some kind of norm? A man in a vehicle smoking a cigarette? Certainly the man part, perhaps. It's a man's world.
Yes. I was just about to say the man. Yeah.
But
the cigarette, I feel like there's got to be something there. There's got to be an explanation. Maybe not a cigarette. The cigarette could be a regression to the mean of something that she saw but didn't know what it was. But in order for the cigarette to seem like, oh, that's probably what it was, there's got to be something. Something where the person's holding their hand up in some way and you see a light or something.
Yeah, and she has since sort of retracted the statement and said that she saw a glow of some kind. I mean, the obvious...
answer is the cell phone.
Is the cell phone.
Yeah.
Trying to get a signal, you might move it around a little weird.
And I don't know how old Faith Westman was, but in 2004, not everyone had a cell phone. So you could see how Faith Westman, she's over the age of like 35, probably didn't have a cell phone, so might not have thought to even consider that as a cell phone, might have assumed light, cigarette. It seems like totally dumb now, especially because so few people smoke now. But again, 2004.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually. Yeah.
Now, I don't know what it means if there was a man in the passenger seat in the car. It
changes absolutely everything.
Yeah, but like, what theory would that fit with? You know?
Something that we haven't thought of yet.
Yeah, she was running away with someone. To me, either you have to completely take the witness statement at face value and say like, no, she saw a man in the driver's seat smoking a cigarette, or you have to say, no, something of that was suspect, in which case any number of other theories are basically equally plausible, because you really can't say that one thing was like more likely than not to be wrong.
Right, exactly.
And it just doesn't make sense that it was a man in the car smoking a cigarette. You can't make that work with the rest of the story.
Right, although I do go back to the fact that there was a cellophane pouch in the car.
Right.
And I don't want to read too much into that, because think about what your car looked like in high school. Think about what my car looked like last week. Like, there's all kinds of stuff in there. And, I mean, I only use rental cars, and I accumulate all kinds of stuff.
Sure.
And I drive people when I have a car, so they might smoke. Like, there's... I really don't think we should read too much into this.
Yeah.
But I do think it always has struck me as odd because of its specificity.
Her account definitely strikes me as odd. What I can't square is that it's 100% accurate. It can't be.
It contradicts every other piece of information that we have.
It only messes with, like, a vague tandem driver theory, I guess.
Yeah. In the episode, they talk about this in the context of it being a person that was traveling with her, or a tandem driver.
Yeah.
To me, I wasn't sure if the timeline sort of worked out, because Faith Westman said this right after the accident. If we think that she crashed at 7:25,
mm-hmm.
and she's saying this around 7:27, but they're talking about the tandem driver.
Yeah, that came later.
There's no way that Faith could have seen the man at the same time that a tandem driver was there, right? Because then she would see the car.
Yeah.
So I don't really know how that works or what they were picturing there.
Yeah, that's a clear example of what you see all over this case, which is like people like taking things, oh, that's weird and that's weird. Oh, there's another person there. Oh, tandem driver is another person. And like a correlating them is like, well, this is part of the tandem driver theory. And I get that you're saying there's another person, and yes, a tandem driver is also another person, sure. But how do you put the person in the car and also being the tandem driver picking her up when Faith Westman didn't see another car? You can't actually connect those dots. They don't physically connect. It's not evidence of the tandem driver, basically. It's evidence, if anything, of the other person in the car, maybe, but not of a tandem driver. Specifically not of a tandem driver.
Right. I agree. I think there's no way that the tandem driver showed up without anyone noticing, because it was the point at which we know literally everyone was watching the scene. That's like the only point that we know, because both Westman and Marat report seeing Butch show up,
mm-hmm.
which is right after Westman called 911. So it's like the one time that we're 100% sure everyone's watching the scene could not be the same point at which the tandem driver shows up.
Right.
Just can't.
Yeah, you can't make it work if everyone's right.
I think we've nailed the phone call part and what she was upset about. She just got out of rehab. She started drinking again. Maura realized it, and that highly upset her. That's what I got out of it.
Mm-hmm. So I think the call's important. I don't necessarily think that her sister had anything to do with her leaving.
Right. Now what we got to figure out is why she decided, you know, to come up here.
Truly. I think that there's a whole other story there.
I agree.
Let's just figure out what happened. Yeah.
So I came to the same conclusion that Art and Maggie came to, which is that what Kathleen says kind of pretty well explains Maura's reported reaction to the phone call and her later statements about having some kind of problem with her sister. It seems very plausible that she'd be very upset.
Yeah.
To your sister, who cares about you, it's deeply upsetting because they don't know what to do. Like, they want you to be happy and they want you to not get hurt. And they're trying to fix everything, especially someone her age, Maura's age. And it's just like, how do I fix this? Like, how do I help her? How do I deal with this, you know, problem that my family member is having? And there's nothing I can do. It's so upsetting.
It's very frustrating. I mean, anyone that has a family member or even a close friend that's an alcoholic understands the feeling of helplessness, that there's just nothing that you can do.
Yeah.
And it's very overwhelming.
Yeah.
And I think one comment that I heard after the fact was like, well, actually, the conversation with her sister took place at 10 o'clock and she didn't break down until closer to 1 o'clock after she talked to Bill. And on its face, it's a decent question, I think. But again, I think anyone who's dealt with a family member that's an alcoholic, you don't have the luxury of breaking down and being emotional. You don't have that luxury when you're the one who has to be stable and strong while you're talking your family member through whatever they're going through. And it makes perfect sense to me that later on, when she's talking to her boyfriend and she's allowed to be, quote, vulnerable, mm-hmm. that she would perhaps become more emotional about it.
Yeah. Like,
that's the point at which it, I won't say hits you, but where you're able to express it.
Yeah.
There's nothing inconsistent about that, I think.
Yeah, I would agree.
Can't prove it, but I think anyone who's been in that situation knows what it's like.
Yeah, definitely.
And then the other interesting thing about Kathleen recently was there was this piece of information that was put out there that the state police showed up and asked her for a DNA sample.
Mm-hmm. What was the conclusion drawn from that?
Well, so it was not stated that there was a warrant that was presented, which is to say that this was entirely voluntary on Kathleen's part. She did not have to participate. She did not want to. If there was a criminal element, they had any evidence,
uh-huh.
there would have presented a warrant.
Right.
And there's something called mitochondrial DNA that is only obtainable from maternal relatives of, in many cases, a victim or some cases a suspect. But basically, in instances where there's a person that's been missing for a long period of time or that has been deceased for a long period of time, sometimes the only way to identify that person is with mitochondrial DNA, which can only be obtained from female relatives.
Right. Well, it can be obtained from anyone, but it only is passed down through female relatives.
Right.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't have been able to get it from Fred.
If they got it from Fred, it wouldn't tell them anything about Maura. Like, she wouldn't have any of his mitochondrial DNA in her. So siblings will share mitochondrial DNA with each other and with their mother, but not with their father. So in most cases, it's going to be most useful to get it from a woman because that tells you about siblings, mother, and daughters. Like, you can establish a link there. Whereas with men, it's like very limited to just siblings that it will provide useful information.
Okay.
So only Maura's siblings would share the same mitochondrial DNA.
Yeah, siblings and mother.
Yeah.
So if I had to guess, I think that they probably obtained the DNA to put in a database of some kind. And I would assume they were anticipating more scrutiny in the near future and want to say that they've done everything possible when questioned. So just throwing that out there.
Yeah.